Please welcome David Rismella.
Oh, wait, now what can I do? As many have said before, gee, I wish my mother would have heard that introduction. Okay, I think we have a special treat for you today, and this is our 25th anniversary year. And I don't know if we've had two speakers before, but we're going to have two speakers today. And I could stand here and talk about each one for 5 or 10 minutes because their accomplishments are so many. I have a full page on each of awards, different kind of awards or degrees that each has received. Two wonderful people. First, I want to mention, though, as you well know, there are cards on the table for you to write your questions down. And a couple of our directors will be circulating. Now, please, on your card, put to Mr. Yanny or to Ambassador Collins or to Yanny, to Collins, so we can sort them out, because I expect quite a few, and I got a helper down here by the name of Alan Horton, immediate past president, who's going to help me out with all your cards. Okay, our first speaker is going to be Ambassador James Collins, and you could write a book on this guy. Harvard cum laude degree, Indiana University master's, studied at Moscow State as an exchange student. He was professor at U.S. Naval Academy, Russian and European history. He speaks fluent Russian. Early in his career with the Foreign Service, he served in Amman, Jordan, and the Consulate General in Izmir, Turkey. He was posted to Moscow in 1973 and 1975. At the State Department, his positions included Deputy Executive Secretary for Europe and Latin America, and policy positions, Bureau of European and Canadian Affairs, Near East and South Asian Affairs, and staff member, National Security Council, and Director of Intelligence Policy. He was assigned to Moscow as Deputy Chief of Mission. When Ambassador Matlock retired, he became Chargé d'Affaires and Acting Ambassador during the 1991 coup d'etat, leading to the breakup of the Soviet Union. A year later, he's ambassador around Christmas in 1991, when I believe it was Gorbachev really signed the resolution that in effect ended the Soviet Union. A number of years later, after the Iron Curtain comes down, more recently, he became our U.S. ambassador to Russia. Just a few of his awards and honorary degrees. Honorary from Indiana University, the Russian Academy of Sciences. Here I have a little problem. Negus Novgorod State University. Jim, did I did okay? Half okay? He said that's all right. Okay, I was close. Secretary of State's Award of Distinguished Services and Secretary of State's Award for a Career Achievement. Since 2007, Ambassador Collins has served as Director of Russian and Eurasian Programs at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Our second speaker, is Mike Yanny, youngest of 9 kids, and his father died when Mike was 11, so Mike learned work ethic at a very early age as he and his brothers and sisters started work very young to provide food, clothing, and housing for the family. Bachelor's degree, University, two honorary doctorate degrees. Long list of business and charitable and civic achievements. One of the more recent, he's a Horatio Alger Association Award. He has the University of Nebraska Distinguished Alumni Award. He and his wife, Dr. Gail Yanny, give back to the community. They founded All Our Kids. It's I think it was 1989, I believe it was. And they started out with 20 high school kids to mentor and get them through high school and on to college. 17 graduated and went on to college. Today, 650 kids, 6th grade through high school, 85% graduate, and 90% then go on to secondary school. 90%. Fabulous record. In Russia, let me get to Russia and Mike. He traveled to Russia at least 100 times before the Iron Curtain came down. He's been to Russia more than 50 times since the Iron Curtain came down. Probably goes once a quarter now, once every 6 months. In 1976, the Minister of Agriculture and the Deputy Premier extended an invitation to Mike to tour the country. Look at their the way they were doing agriculture, raising crops. He was the first American to take such a tour since World War II. It ended up that he was offered a pilot program to plant 10,000 hectares of soybeans, and maybe he'll tell you a little bit about that. And he's been honored at numerous Russian events, and I won't even list them all. Early in his career, he was in banking, and he decided he wanted to go into investment banking, and with the help of his wife, an anesthesiologist, why they got started. And over the time, numerous investment funds, both institutional as well as individual investors. One of the ones I'll mention right now, they raised over $100 million in 1996, and what they did was invest in Russia, privatizing Russia, and all the companies were ag-related. It were 89 companies, which they funded and managed. They were fortunate enough that they saw what was happening, what was coming in Russia, and they sold everything in the 2000-2007 era at huge profits to their investors. So Mike has much experience in Russia, and he'll talk about that today. So for starters, join me in welcoming Ambassador Jim Collins to the podium.
Well, thank you very much, David. And I must say I am very humbled to be here with this kind of an audience. I think it says something about the topic that I can turn out a room this size, or at least Dave and his colleagues can, to talk about Russia. There are those who think Russia's history, it's sort of last century's business. Well, I'm here to suggest that's not quite the case, and I want to say one or two things about why I think that's true. I really want to touch on 6 points. First one is that if you look at Russia today, something is going on. There is a period of transition always in Russia, it seems to me, but at this particular time, it looks to me like we have an entire society that is trying to think about now what. They're coming out of a very difficult financial crisis, and the financial crisis in many ways hit Russia harder than it did this country. They are having stubborn unemployment. They are having difficulty returning the economy to anything like its pre-crisis levels. Even though there's been a turnaround, it's unequally applied. And this is producing discontent. I think you wouldn't be surprised. You have the first times in which the public is questioning President Putin's leadership, now Prime Minister Putin. You have the first times in which people are basically saying, we are not satisfied with the way the Russian bureaucracy is running the country. And in particular, we have problems with things like police abuse. So something's going on. What really seems to be going on is that we're seeing people say, what we have and have had for a period of recovery is not good enough for the future. Now that's a major statement at this point, by the Russian people. The second thing that's going on is that within the political class, the political elites, the intelligentsia, as the Russians call them, there's a debate. And it's a debate that's taking place on two levels. One debate isn't so much a verbal one as it is an implicit debate. And it is going on between the people who have profited from Russia's recovery after the collapse of the Soviet Union, who basically are tied to an economy which is based on commodities, on the extraction of minerals, on cutting down trees, essentially a raw materials commodity export group of people where the money is. And the system they've got working essentially favors that community. The tax structure, the way in which the export rules are written, and so forth. The people who are challenging that are what I would call the value-added people. They're the people who say, wait a minute, you know, all we're doing is sending our oil, our natural gas, our timber, and so forth, for somebody else to make into something. We ought to be doing that. Unless we can develop a society which can manage that process, we don't have a future. Now, those people have called themselves, in a sense, modernizers. They want to take the economy another stage. And within this group, there's another debate. It's a debate, a very old debate. In many ways, it goes back two centuries. It is between those people who think, essentially, the way you can make the economy develop and prosper is by working on a horizontal model. That is, entrusting entrepreneurship, popular business creation, a market system, and so forth, as the basic way in which you can bring prosperity. That is a minority view, and it has been all along. The other group is a group with a long tradition. It goes back to Peter the Great at the beginning of the 18th century. It has been with us for two centuries through Joseph Stalin. And fundamentally, it said, you can't trust the public to do that, to make those achievements, to get us out of our economic problems. You have to have central control. You have to have people at the top who know what's right for the public, making decisions about what will get investment, who will be able to make the decisions on what is important, and so forth. Now, that argument is going on now, and you have it, in a sense, between a group of people who are what I would call the democratic modernizers and the people who believe in what they're calling conservative modernization, which is another way of saying the central government and the bureaucracy are going to manage it. And it will be done essentially by them deciding where the money and investment will go. The third point I would make is that the burden of history certainly does not favor the democratic modernizers. But this time, something's different about the conditions under which this debate's taking place and where it seems to be going. Nobody knows how it's going to turn out, and anyone who will tell you he does really, well, simply needs a greater degree of humility. But the reality is it's only in its early stages. And it's just beginning to get formulated, and people are just beginning to discuss where are we going now, how are we going to do it. Now, what's different this time about the debate, it is that it is taking place in a totally different context from any of the Russian debates on this subject that have taken place for the last 400 years. And that is that it is taking place in a Russia which is essentially an open society, one that is no longer isolated from the rest of the world, no longer cut off and controlled by its central authorities, one where the outside world has a capacity to make a difference for the way Russians see themselves and their relationship to the rest of the world. I simply give you one point to give you a sense of what I mean. When I went to Moscow in the fall of 1990, actually Naomi and I, my wife and I, arrived on Halloween, and I thought it was sort of symbolic. There were 1,200 international phone lines that connected the Soviet Union with the outside world by phone. There were others, but they were totally controlled by certain organs, as we used to call them. There are now 150 million cell phones in the Russian Federation. Now, what that means in practice is that if you could control 1,200 international lines, which you could in 1990, the whole thing is totally out of control now. Anyone can talk to anyone. Internet is widespread and it's growing. There is a broad and much richer debate than ever before within the society, both within and with the outside world. Now, I would like then to turn a little bit to what are the implications for us of all this. First of all, I think it's important to remember that Russia still is important. The world has changed, it's true. We no longer have the world in which most of us grew up, which was divided into two camps, the communist world and the non-communist world, or as we called it, the free world. It was a bipolar geopolitical system in which the two nuclear superpowers more or less set the agenda and defined the shape of developments in many, many respects. Well, that world's gone, and it has changed remarkably rapidly, almost into something that would be unrecognizable to the people who are graduating high school today from where we were when we graduated high school. Now, that said, even though it is no longer a bipolar world, it doesn't mean that Russia is no longer important to us. And I simply want to suggest to you why Russia remains important. Russia basically is in touch with us in three key areas: Asia, South Asia, Middle East, and Europe. We run up against Russia in almost every policy issue in those areas, in one way or another. And so for America to pursue our interests, our goals, our objectives, to bring along the international community in directions that we think are important, you're going to need the Russians as partners. Now, you can either have cooperative partners or you can have difficult partners, and Russia has a capacity for both, I can assure you, and will into the future. But the fact of the matter is, Russia is going to be a major partner for the United States, and it is one where we have a stake in how they play the international game and how they develop. I would go back here to this debate that's going on internally. We have a stake in that as well, because in many ways, the democratic westernizing forces, as I would call them, are far more likely to accept a Russia that finds its place in Europe, finds its place in the international system in ways that will work cooperatively and effectively with us, than one which is feeling besieged, feeling under attack, and feeling that it has to differentiate itself from Europe and the West and protect itself from other forces in Asia and the Middle East. My fifth point is essentially that we can make a difference. Now, Washington has a way of talking which suggests always that managing the world is very hard work. And, you know, other people just don't get it. They need to get on with our agenda, and we need to be able to lead. At this point, the idea that we had at the early 90s, where we could in some ways shape the future of Russia, has now clearly and transparently evaporated as a possibility. Russia has recovered. It's got its own economic independence back. It is a powerful, major international player. But we do have the ability to affect the context within which Russia is going to make these decisions during that debate. And this is where I would argue we need a consistent and strong American policy that pays attention to what we're doing as it affects Russia and Russia's neighbors. So here I would say we were at a low point at the end of the Bush administration for a whole variety of reasons in our relations with Russia. The current administration made a basic decision that we had to do something differently in order to get ourselves back to a more productive and cooperative relationship with the Russian Federation. They called it a reset. Now, the reset's had some successes. It's had some failures. My basic point about it is a good beginning, but it's fragile. We're going to get a strategic arms reduction agreement in the next few weeks, I suspect. We have an extraordinarily new productive agreement where Russia is supporting our efforts in Afghanistan. We have a new commission that is exploring all kinds of new ways in which we can do positive things together, but it's all fragile. None of it can be taken for granted. If we get a START agreement, it's got to be ratified, and that's going to be difficult. With Afghanistan, we've only begun. With most of these other areas, we need to do more. So my point here is we have opportunities now. What we need to do is find the ways that are going to be effective to take advantage of them and to build support, frankly, for those in the Russian system who want to see us as a productive partner too. And I would conclude here with just a couple of thoughts about what's it take to do that. And I would give you only three ideas. First, you have to have a commitment to the goal. You cannot see Russia as an episodic partner. Someone who is important today because, I don't know, they've done something outrageous, but is not tomorrow, because we've got other more important things to do. It takes sustained commitment to engaging the Russians and working with them through hard diplomacy, frustrations, positive achievements, but you don't give up. Now, the Russian side doesn't always make that easy, I can assure you, but it is worth the process. Secondly, we need to build on the things that we have managed to do and continue and get some other work done. We need to ratify the START agreement when it comes. We need to expand what we're doing with them in places like Afghanistan and the Middle East. We are going to need to get, we need somehow to get them into the World Trade Organization and finally do more work with them on things like nuclear proliferation cooperation. We need to build on what's already in place and strengthen it. It's my conviction that Russia in rules-based international organizations is a Russia that is much more likely to work with us than one that is outside the tent. And so it's important to do that. And finally, I think it's important to work with the Russians in adapting to a new world. We're all in a new world today. And we need to rethink our vocabulary and our conception about what it is to work with a country like the Russian Federation, which for several centuries has been on our radar screen, mainly as an adversary. What's changing? The geopolitical system of the globe is in flux. It is not what it was 20 years ago. The rise of Asia, of China and India, economically, has altered the entire economic picture. The political consequences of that are only beginning to be felt. But one thing is pretty clear. Our preoccupation for two centuries that the biggest issue for us and our European allies was preventing any hostile power from dominating Europe is now not really an issue anymore. There's not going to be any single dominant power in Europe. Europe is a new community. The Russians clearly are not in a position to play the role of the Soviet Union. And we are therefore faced with a new challenge in Europe where Russia is central. And that challenge is essentially trying to realize the vision that people had at the collapse of the Soviet Union and the end of the communist system, which was to build a Europe whole and free. That is an objective that is in our interest, and it's an objective we will accomplish only with an effective Russia policy. So with that, I will leave it. And I want to ask Mike, I think, to now give you some reality rather than what I've just given you.
Mike is next, but before, I want to introduce two special guests today. We have Dr. Naomi Collins seated here at our table. Naomi, please stand, and Dr. Gail Yanni. Would you please welcome them? And now our next speaker, Mike Yanni. Mike.
Good afternoon. You know, I know I just heard one of the most profound speeches on the current state of affairs in Russia and the surrounding countries. And I believe it was just delivered to you by one of the great patriots of the United States and Ambassador Jim Collins. And let's just give him one more round. I want to tell you a little about Dave Rissmiller, and I'll do it rather quickly. That's right, Dave. Dave Rissmiller came to Omaha many years ago and became chief executive of the largest bank in our region. It had lots of problems, being under a special letter from the Comptroller of Currency, and in a period of 8 years, he ran the bank and sold it to U.S. banks. He gave the investors an incredible return and actually outperformed Warren Buffett in those 8 years. Now, Gail and I have been the beneficiaries of a fine friendship with Dave, and we thoroughly appreciate them. I want to tell you, as a career banker, I never dreamed that I would be someday finding myself doing business in the former Soviet Union. Crazy opportunity came my way in the middle of the 1970s. I received a call from the Secretary of Agriculture, who was Earl Butz. He asked if my wife and I would be willing to host a Soviet ambassador and his wife and granddaughter. The ambassador at that time was a rather famous one named Anatoly Dobrynin. When I first asked my wife about what the agricultural secretary had asked us, she said to me, "Why should we ever have a communist stay in our house?" Well, you know, we went to dinner that night, and after much discussion, we both said, "You know, let's give it a try." The Union Pacific provided us with the executive train of the railroad, and we took them on a beautiful ride across Nebraska agriculture. Then we flew them to a ranch in the Sand Hills. The ambassador was really surprised. Here was a ranch with electricity, indoor bathrooms, and a beautiful ranch house. They checked their cattle fences with a Piper Cub, which he immediately said, "I have to fly in." And he did fly in it. Little did I realize that a few weeks later, I would be invited to Moscow to take a 17-day trip through several areas of the Soviet Union. Most of the time, the Minister of Agriculture and some of his deputies were escorting me through a well-planned program. And I must say, it was very well-planned. When we returned to Moscow, we went into the Minister of Agriculture's boardroom. There were 20 of the ag leaders in the room, a number of his deputies, and of course, the KGB was there. Now, let's remember, this was 1977. Brezhnev was Secretary General of the Soviet Union, and we were in a deep Cold War. They proposed to me that I put together a team to raise 10,000 hectares or 25,000 acres of soybeans in four locations across the Soviet Union. I'd never seen a soybean plant before, but I had financed soybeans at one time or another. They wanted it to be a private enterprise farming run by my farmers and scientists from the United States, and all the technology and the equipment from the United States. Now, the man who really wanted this done was a young man named Mikhail Gorbachev, who had just moved from Stavropol, Russia, to Moscow, and was the liaison between the Ministry of Agriculture and the Politburo. When I told our Secretary of Ag what was going on, he was absolutely stunned. We went ahead and submitted a proposal, and a month later I returned to the Soviet. I received a telegram, because you had nothing else, as Ambassador Collins was saying. I received a Western Union telegram telling me to come over right away. They've turned you down. I couldn't understand it, but I went over anyway, and then I learned that they wanted us to go ahead with the project, but they wanted it to be a management consulting project, but do everything else that you said you're going to do. Now, I want to tell you, I stayed on collective farms, state farms. I stayed in country hotels. Several of the hotels did not have toilets. None of them had telephones that worked. One of the farms in Krasnodar was right adjacent to a backfire bomber base. I doubt that there were many other Americans around that backfire bomber base. I really saw communism in its roughest form And I was, and it, clearly, communism didn't work. And this was back in 1977. Soviet communism didn't reward people or organizations for making change. So why should they make change? It was interesting because this their agricultural scientists were bright, capable, and for the most part knew really what had to be done. Yet they couldn't get the farming organizations to execute their plans. Their soybean harvesters, for instance, left 15% of the crop in the field. Our John Deere soybean harvesters left 2 to 3% in the field. And when you start talking about 25,000 hectares and you leave 15% in the field, you're talking about an awful lot of soybeans. It all seems so strange to me. They could fly a supersonic at supersonic speeds, put a satellite into orbit, explode enormous nuclear bombs, and they couldn't grow and harvest the food for their people. In my mind, communism didn't work then, and I don't think it works now any place in the world. The people were as fine a people as I have ever worked with in any country. But the frustrations for them were huge, and the motivations were non-existent. Having considerable vodka in the evening and cognac for breakfast was kind of the modus operandi. We did some 40 contracts between 1977 and 1986. They ranged from renovating and planting cranberry bogs in Belarus to a turnkey drip irrigation plant in Rostov-on-the-Don to cotton production in Uzbekistan. In all cases, the people were great to us. They were warm, hospitable, and you couldn't help but admire them. They were paid very little and had very little material goods or toys. Now, speaking of the cranberry bogs in Belarus, they were only 90 miles north of Chernobyl, where the nuclear plant explosion took place. 7 years after the explosion, I got permission from both governments to bring back a little peck of cranberries, and that took a lot of work to be able to do that. And I wanted to have them inspected by the nuclear station in the north part of Omaha, Nebraska. All I can tell you is, those cranberries lit up red lights like you couldn't believe. Now, several times I went to the Minister of Agriculture of both countries and said, you need to quarantine these immediately. Finally, we got permission from the governments to quarantine. But now if you want to see what's happened over there, you've got an epidemic of thyroid cancer. It was amazing to me how much money was spent by the KGB spying on us, as well as spying on the Russians that were working with us. Centralized government planning, socialism, communism, or whatever you want to call it, just doesn't work. Yet we have people in this country who are working full-time to screw up our democracy and our democratic capitalism. In 1995, after the revolution, I wrote Boris Yeltsin a letter, and told him we would like to form, a venture capital fund, and we want to invest in private enterprise in your country, and I wanted to know if he would support and be able to protect us as much as possible from crooks and corruption. Much to my amazement, the response was quick and it was decisive. He appointed a man from the office of the president to be directly coordinating with us. We proceeded to purchase or start 8 different businesses. We employed over 9,000 people, and for most of them, it was the first time they ever received a paycheck twice every 2 weeks. We became the largest chicken producer in European Russia. We became the largest maker of glass bottles in European Russia. We started and developed the largest dairy in Kazakhstan, and did business in several other countries. But I have a message. We saw and experienced an incredible transformation from communism to a modified democracy. The working people were experiencing the dynamism of working, being motivated, getting paid, and seeing sizable pay increases, and getting paid vacations and traveling without basic restrictions. That reminds me of a situation in 1979 when the Minister of Agriculture and I went to St. Petersburg, or what was then called Leningrad, as a special guest of the mayor. When we arrived, it was really ridiculous, but I didn't have papers to travel outside of Moscow. The minister and the mayor argued for 4.5 hours in the lobby of the hotel with the KGB. They finally worked it out and kept me from being tossed in jail. Thanks to the Minister of Foreign Trade, who we found in Moscow and knew me, who intervened with the KGB in Moscow, and they in turn released us. Think of that. Now today, the general population is really well educated. They love their cultural events, and the incredible new grocery stores, and beautiful new hotels and shopping centers. And oh yes, all the apartments and dachas are just considerably improved in the big cities. I believe, especially because the world economy being in such bad shape, their unemployment is going up much too fast. Unless it turns around, it will create more problems for the government than they want. But I am convinced that their modified democracy, one way or another, will sustain itself, and ultimately their economy will turn around. That doesn't mean there still isn't a lot of poverty and one whale of a lot of corruption. We sold all of our businesses in 2006 and 7, quite fortunately. However, of great concern, we wanted to be good corporate citizens, and we were. We tried to represent our country with very high standards, and we kept our integrity and our credibility. And I think it's a marvelous story of how Russian people were trained to run Russian businesses to Western standards and were motivated to get great results. Let me tell one story that somewhat epitomizes the way our company does business. We have a policy of no gifts over $300 to anyone that was doing business with us or people we anticipated doing business with or any government officials. It's a one-strike policy and you're out. And we've executed that policy twice in 30 years. That was established in 1977 when we first started doing business in the Soviet Union. And now after 34 years, it's still the same policy and the same amount. In 1984, a fairly large American corporation had asked my assistance in negotiating a contract for a turnkey plant and some licenses. The chief executive, his lawyer, and I went to Moscow to close the deal. We had everything pre-negotiated. Everything had been done very well. When we entered the boardroom, with all the usual Russians sitting around the table, the chief negotiator came over to me and gave me a big bear hug and said, "We need to go out in the hallway for a discussion." Vladimir was a good friend of mine, and I had done a number of contracts with him. When we left the room, he told me he needed a big favor. He needed a new 1985 Chevrolet delivered to his New York address. My response was very simple. Put it in the contract, and if the Minister of Foreign Trade approves of it as part of the contract, it's a done deal. His response was, yet. This is for me personally. I asked, "Are you serious, Vladimir?" And he said, "Absolutely." And he said, "Without that, there's no contract." I called the chief executive and his lawyer out of the room and told them of Vladimir's demand. They argued with him by themselves, came back and said, "We're going to increase your fee and you get the car for it." My response was very simple. These discussions are over. My car and driver are outside and in front of the building, and I'm out of here. Without going into a lot more details, of which there are, I got to my car and Vladimir came running out of the building and said, "The Minister of Foreign Affairs or Foreign Trade will approve of it, and we'll put it in the contract." Now, let me tell you, this was November of 1984. January 5th of 85, I was to meet with him in the Amtorg offices in New York City. When I called his secretary the day before, his secretary said he no longer worked here. That was strange, because in the communist system, you just don't say you no longer work there. So I called Ambassador Dobrynin, who was still on his last year of being there, and he told me Vladimir defected to the FBI and was a counter spy for foreign corrupt practices. Now, all I can say, if I had purchased the car as that chief executive had wanted me to, that gift would probably still have me in prison. Let's finish this talk with something I am very passionate in my thoughts and my actions. Regardless of the enormity of our problems in this country, our democracy and our democratic capitalism is absolutely the finest in the world. We must become engaged. Every one of us must become engaged, and we should be passionate about protecting our democracy and our democratic capitalism. And I welcome all of you for being here today and listening to these two speeches. Thank you.
Right here. Those are obviously two very outstanding programs that we really appreciate, and those are the kind of programs that the Forum Club tries to have. And now we have some special questions, and we will both speakers. Yeah. Yeah. Right now. Come on up. Oh, right. I have some special thanks. I have some special presentations from the Forum Club, and I'll have these at the table for you. All right. Come on in.
Thank you, Wade. What Wade is going to give to each of you is a book on Naples and one on Marco Island. So we hope you enjoy reading about this nice area where you spent the last couple days. Well, as you might expect, we have a few questions.
Sorry. Go ahead. Excuse me.
And I'm not sure where to start because I have so many good questions, but let's try this one. We have a couple that have come to the point of saying Russia's had some overwhelming negative trends. Do you have any more that you would like to say about the negativism before I get to the ones that are positive, okay?
Jim. Yours truly. Well, I mean, I think the great unanswered question in some ways is whether the Russian people, and particularly this new generation of post-Soviet citizens, are really going to become citizens, or they're still going to remain subjects. And in a sense, that's the critical question. Is the Russian government system going to become a government that, in effect, engages its people in the process of governing? Or is it going to remain a system which, with all of its burdens and history, governs through bureaucracy, central control, and essentially governs where an elite governs subjects? We don't know the answer to that, I think. But the negatives, whether it's the burden of a long-standing tradition of surveillance and secret police, of control of the citizen, of viewing the citizen in what is a very popular American term, a human resource, rather than a human being, is something that is very profound, and it has huge effects. And I think it's really the question to watch as to whether that begins to change, whether they begin to be citizens and seen as part of the process, or they remain subjects and in a sense, a unit of production.
Any comments about alcoholism in Russia? I have at least four questions about that.
Well, look, I mean, let's broaden the question to talk about demographics.
Thank you.
The Russian population is declining. I've seen projections that say by 2030 it could be down to from what it was of about almost 150 million in 1991. To 130 million or so by 2030, and it could go as low as 110 million by 2050. Now, this is profoundly a problem, and it is in many ways a health problem. The lifespan of the average Russian male born today is 59 years. And the reality is that is in essence because there is a poor health care system, public health is broken, but also the lifestyle of the Russian male is frankly designed to create early death. It is high cholesterol, too much alcohol, don't move, I used to say that it's a lifestyle that we apply to feed cattle. And essentially, this is a life that's meant to be short. Now, can they change this? It's a great question. It can be changed, but whether the will be there to do it or not is not clear.
Next question, again for you, Ambassador, is the Muslim and Russian relationship. Could you speak to that point, please?
Well, first of all, we need to remember that while Russia is much more homogeneous than it used to be as the Soviet Union, and it's about 80% Russian today as a nation state, something like 15 to 17% of the population is non-Russian and is Muslim. So the first point is that the Russian relationship with the Muslim world is partly a domestic issue, much more so than it is, say, in the United States or most of Europe. Secondly, their relationship with the Muslim world, in a sense, begins on their immediate borders. All of Central Asia is Muslim to one degree or another. They are neighbors with Iran, and they are active and have been active in most of the Middle East. So they have a long relationship with Muslim nations. I think the relationship is between two very different cultures, because the Russian culture is fundamentally Christian Orthodox. But it's also a relationship which is having to adjust as you have, in some sense, challenges to the Russian traditional relationships from newly emerging Muslim powers. And their immediate issue is how do they manage the relationship with their immediate neighbors to the south. They're not bad, but they're, I would say, fluid and uncertain as the future goes forward.
Thank you. There are several questions on, and you've touched on it previously, but on their health system, the public health. Is there such a thing, and would you please comment? Obviously a great deal of interest because of what may be voted on in this country on Sunday.
Well, in the Soviet period, you had a total state-run health care system. And everybody was entitled to free health care and so forth. Well, that was fine. The problem was it wasn't very good, except for the top end of the elite. I personally went, I have to give the Soviet system credit because it probably saved my life. I had a collapsed lung. I spent 17 days in a hospital in Moscow, which was one of the Kremlin system, and it was very good. They also had a pretty good public health system. I mean, the water supplies and other things were quite good. And they, in that sense, the Soviet Union had made huge strides compared to what had been there in the 30s or 40s. When the Soviet Union collapsed, both of these systems in many ways also collapsed. They have been replaced now, in some sense, by private insurance on one hand and a surviving old state public health system, which fundamentally doesn't work. What you have today is basically health care, which you as citizens pay for. You normally have insurance through your employer, but it is very poor in its coverage. It's fine in Moscow, it's fine in St. Petersburg and some of the big urban centers. But in the rural areas, health care is very poor. What I'd say is it's not a state system anymore, is the reality. The state system has broken down, and you almost have no system. So what they're going to come up with in the next decade or so is one of the great deferred issues for the Russian public.
I have, again, more than one question on corruption. I think Mike has touched on that quite a bit. I don't know, Mike, do you have any additional comments?
Well, all I can say is I don't know of a country in the world where you don't find corruption, including this country. Why worry about it if you're not going to be a part of it?
That's good. Okay, next question. moving right along. That's very well said. Talk for a couple of minutes about your experience when you were there in 1991, when I think there were tanks and troops outside. where you were staying, living?
Well, you know, I'd never been part of a coup before, frankly. And first of all, geographically, it's important to understand one thing. When the American embassy stood, in a sense, let's say, where this table is, and the building in which the Russian state government, not the federal Soviet government, the Russian state government of Boris Yeltsin, was about where that table is. So we were neighbors. What happened, essentially, is I got up one morning, Monday morning, I remember it very well, 19th of August, and my political officer on duty called me at 3 minutes after seven and said, "Have you heard the news? Mikhail Gorbachev has been deposed, and he is in the south, and we have a new government in place." I had just taken over charge of the embassy and the American community in Moscow, and I didn't really welcome this. But what happened in the next 3 days was quite interesting. You had a standoff between the people who had taken power in the Kremlin, which was, let's say, over across the street, and the group of which we were the immediate neighbors and headed by Boris Yeltsin in what was then called the White House. Now, in the first day, what happened is they built a whole series of barricades around the Yeltsin White House and Kanban in where we were inside. And the real question was, what was going to happen? Nobody knew. Would the army obey the people who were conducting the coup, or would they choose not to confront the people who were around Yeltsin? We had a very tense day. There was shooting. We had three casualties, not Americans, but Russians, right outside the embassy. And had there been, in a sense, an attack and a mob panic, the embassy would have been overrun. So it was a tense time. My only point, as I was asked to go and see Yeltsin and then talk to our president, George Bush Sr., and so forth, was in the early days, don't assume this is going to succeed. Well, in fact, that looked pretty good because it collapsed in 3 days. But it was a tense period, and it gave you a sense for two or three things which my wife has described in a book she wrote called Dark Days and White Nights. First, you can't believe in predictions. Nobody predicted this coup. Second, there's a degree in which just plain serendipity shapes large historic events. Why didn't the coup plotters capture Boris Yeltsin? Why didn't they shut down CNN? I mean, it was partly ineptitude, but it was partly luck. And thirdly, understand that even though there are many forces and economics and historic trends and so forth that shape history, in the end, people matter. Individuals mattered in those 3 days, and if we hadn't had a certain constellation of particular figures, we would have potentially had a very different outcome. So I credit my wife's historical perspective for that. She was writing while I was trying to keep everybody out of the embassy.
Okay, we've run over a few minutes, and I hope you don't mind, but I hope you found the Q&A interesting, and again, it's been a privilege to have Mike Yanni and Ambassador Collins here today.
Dave, I have one thing for you. For you and your wife, here's a copy of that book.
Thank you.
So you can get know more than you want to know about.
All right. Thank you. Do I get an autograph, too?
It is autographed. Oh, thank you. Yeah. Thank you, everyone, and we'll see you in 3 weeks. 3 weeks. All right. Thank you very much. Hope that was all right.